Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to ScaryCast. This is Dr. John. We've got a bang-up show lined up for everybody tonight. Glad to have all of you listeners with us. I see we got some folks in, and we're going to have a grand old time tonight. Our guest is Preston Dennett. He is an author that has written many, many books, and one caught my attention about a week ago, and I'll let him introduce that book in just a minute. I did want to say, first of all, my book, Bigfoot Explorers, by myself and illustrated by my business partner, Cody Haynes, the great caricature artist here in Myrtle Beach, is now on sale, and you can go to bishopville.org, as usual, check it out, and you can buy a copy. It's $12 plus shipping, and it's got some really great things. I will say, first of all, thank you to Jen Cruz and the She Squatchers for all the information they provided. They even provided the cover photo for the book. It is some Bigfoot tracks heading almost straight up a gravel hillside, and it's just a brilliant photograph. And there's a little short article about that, also as well about the She Squatchers. And by the way, everybody, the She Squatchers will be at the Kansas City Paracon this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They will have copies of the book on sale. I got them 3 dozen copies shipped out today, so they will have them in time for Kansas City Paracon. So please go by their table and see them, Jen, Jenna, and I think maybe one or two more of the She Squatchers will be there. Thank Lyle Blackburn, my buddy Lyle, for putting together a special article for Bigfoot Explorers. As we all know, he is identified with a number of cryptids, including, of course, the in Folk, Arkansas, and I just can't think of what it is, but the very famous film that he and Seth Breedlove did, and I've just had a Myrtle Beach moment. And I also want to thank, of course, Jen Cruz for helping with some of the commentary, and also Angelia Shear, a very dear friend of mine from Nashville. Angelia is the head of Tennessee MUFON, and she helped me with a really nice story for the last section in the book about the UFO Bigfoot connection. Very, very interesting. We talk about UFOs, Bigfoot, some things that John Keel recognized, including transmogrification. Big, long word, but an interesting, interesting topic. And then, so just thanks to everybody involved. Again, Cody Haynes, what a great business partner, what a great friend, putting together the wonderful, wonderful caricatures that are in the book. So thanks to all my friends and everybody, and I hope everybody enjoys it. And again, big plug for the She Squatchers. Check them out at the Kansas City Paracon this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and it will be a blast. So anyway, tonight, I want to introduce esteemed author, paranormal dude. Preston, that's what I call myself. I think I'm a paranormal dude sometimes. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Preston Dennett. How are you doing tonight from California?
Hey, doing great. Yeah, thanks for having me on the ScaryCast. I'm excited.
We're so glad to have you here. I get an email about every other week from UFOs over cashiers. That's Cashiers, North Carolina. And they had a blurb about your book about UFO bases in general in the area of the Pacific Ocean. First of all, tell everybody the name of the book, where you can buy it, and where the primary zone or radius of these UFO bases you discuss are. Take it away, Preston.
Right. Thanks very much. Well, the book is called Undersea UFO Base. It's originated actually as a chapter in one of my other books, UFOs Over California, which focused on USO accounts under unidentified submerged objects off the coast of Southern California here. And to publicize the book, I wrote an article for Fate magazine, and I called it, Is There an Undersea UFO Base off the Southern California Coast? Because I was getting some really intriguing reports and a lot of evidence pointing towards, you know, the possibility of a base. And so that article actually went viral. It did really well. It got picked up by news organizations, was translated into different languages, got published all over the internet, and I started speaking about the subject. And so that's how kind of how this book came about, Undersea UFO Base, and focuses pretty much exclusively on this one area called the San Pedro Channel, the Santa Catalina Channel, is what it's known locally as. But, yeah, this body of water lies between Catalina Island, which is about 26 miles off the coast of Los Angeles, and the mainland. And it's a pretty deep body of water. It reaches about a mile deep in parts. And there's a whole lot of UFO activity here and USO activity, objects coming in and out of the water, and just some really bizarre cases and other evidence pointing towards this undersea base theory that I've been developing. And, you know, I think I've got enough evidence now to say that there's something really weird going on here.
Well, you know, Preston, I've got this phrase, where there's smoke, there may be fire, but where there's a lot of smoke, the fire is right there. And I think you may chuckle, and I think you know what I mean. When there's so much evidence, then something's there. There just really is. And what, you know, other than you, because you're the one that I believe has spearheaded the research and publications in this area, what are the feds doing? What do you hear out of the government about this? I mean, you know, obviously they know what's going on, but I mean, what do you hear from them, if anything?
Oh, they definitely know what's going on. I know I've got numerous cases that support that. I mean, there was one guy, a professor of Santa Monica College. He was drawn out of his house one evening by helicopters hovering over the area of the Santa Monica Mountains here, which overlooks the coast. And this was something other people had complained about, helicopters that were hovering over the area, and this was often on nights after a big UFO event. And he goes outside, and he's thinking, you know, what's going on? Is there a drug bust or something? Because he sees, you know, cars on the fire break and two or three helicopters sitting on searchlights. And evading these helicopters is what it looked like was this UFO. He described it as being absolutely like mirror silver, chrome. And it's just gliding down below the level of the mountains, totally silent, about 60 miles an hour or so, down towards the ocean. So the government or someone's, the military, was totally aware of what was going on. This was during the mid-1990s. There was a huge UFO wave there. They were definitely aware of it. Have to believe they're aware of what's going on off the coast here, because, gosh, at least a quarter of the witnesses are themselves military. So a lot of the witnesses are people who are on Navy ships, or, you know, submarines even, or airline pilots. So yeah, I'm absolutely convinced they know what's going on. What they're doing about it, they're monitoring the situation, certainly, but don't know beyond that.
Well, I mean, that's good enough for today. I know that you're continuing to look for answers. You're kind of like a real and I don't mean this badly, but I'm a real researcher. I'll go out in the field. I'll get dirty. I'll maybe take a few dangerous steps that I shouldn't. And I think you're kind of a get-down-and-dirty researcher too, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think armchair research has its value. It's good to know your books and stuff and what other researchers are doing. But if you're not out there tromping through the fields and, you know, interviewing people firsthand and checking out witness locations and trying to see the stuff yourself, I mean, that's where the true pay dirt is.
Exactly. And I know one thing that I do, I'm very fortunate that I work for myself. I do work a lot, but I have time that I can stay in contact with a network of friends who have their finger on the pulse of various issues that I like to talk about, such as Lizard Man, Bigfoot, Mothman, UFOs, and psychic research. And you know, I'm very fortunate, and a lot of those are working with me on some experiments as we try to move forward to figure out what's going on. Because as I tell people, and this is, I guess, the first time you and I have gotten to have a really kind of like a pleasant chat where we can kind of discuss how we feel about things. But I know that 100 years ago, if you had looked at a friend and said, do you know that one day there will be a little black box? It'll be the size less than a 3x5 note card, and you'll be able to talk to someone halfway around the world in real time. They would have either said that's witchcraft or they would have thought you were crazy. Am I correct?
I remember watching Star Trek.
Oh yeah. And that now we have these. And then when we as paranormal researchers, when we look at things, this is the true hardcore science of 100 years from now. And all I got to say is Galileo and Copernicus were tortured. At least I don't think I'll be tortured unless I go to Myanmar or North Korea, which I'm not going to do, and present this research. But we've got to look at this, because if we don't, I can guarantee you major universities are not. These R1 universities are so tied into the National Science Foundation grants that they wouldn't dare talk about this kind of stuff. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox on that. But anyway, yeah, it's good to meet another, you know, researcher that likes to get their feet dirty. Now I try not to go out and hunt for Bigfoot, but now just as an aside, if you don't mind, then we'll get right back to the UFO topic, which is important. But you told me that you had a little bit of a Bigfoot story. You'd done some research, met a lady who had an interesting story. Do you mind giving the short version of that? Because I thought it was a really neat story. Do you mind doing that?
Oh, no, not at all. I was dragged into UFOs kind of kicking and screaming, and it was even worse with Bigfoot. I just did not want to look into it until I started running into cases of UFOs and Bigfoot coming together. There was a guy out in Canyon Country. That's another story. But this other lady, she had some UFO encounters, and then she calls me up and says, there's Bigfoot has come to my house. You know, I feel like she felt like she was having telepathy with it. Her son saw it. Her roommate saw it. The neighbors saw it. The horses were going crazy. She felt like she knew where it lived. And she's like, you got to come up here and check this out. And I did, and I saw the tree where it broke in. And, you know, it was a long story, but she took me up to this hillside where she thought it lived. This is on the edge of the Los Angeles National Forest. She lived in Acton in Southern California, and it turns out there is a lot of Bigfoot UFO activity there. And it was about dusk, you know, getting pretty dark, especially out there where it's full of brush. And we had all kinds of equipment, sound equipment, photographic equipment, just her and I. And she's like, it lives in this area, I'm telling you. We pulled off the road, opened the doors, put the equipment on the hood of the car, when this thing roars. And I could tell instantly it was close and coming from, you know, this hillside that was really dark and covered in brush. The witness, she screams and rushes for the car. This thing roars again. She says it roars three times. I'm pretty sure it was just twice. But I'm telling you, the second time it roared, you know, I'd been next to a lion in a zoo when it roared. And Lip grew up in the Santa Monica Mountains where there was all kinds of coyotes and bobcat and things like this. We had a bobcat that lived near our house. So this was not any of those. And I'm telling you, man, when I heard that thing, I just knew that this was nothing I've heard before. It's crazy.
Well, that's amazing. And one thing that you mentioned, I don't realize if you know what I really do when I get people on ScaryCast. I also ask them if they are interested in my projects and would like to join. I think the Bigfoot UFO connection is just a phenomenal thing. As I was looking into this, John Keel, who wrote the Mothman Prophecies, talked about a process called transmogrification. Well, that's a pretty big word, pretty and big word, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
Well, let me tell you what, I don't know if you've heard of it, because I just ran across this. I'm such a big fan of John Keel and the Mothman Prophecies. What he talked about was that there seems to be a certain stages in certain sightings, like in terms of UFOs and Bigfoots. First of all, Bigfoot. I'm sorry, I misused the term. In terms of Bigfoot, first of all, he says that people will see lights, star-sized lights in the sky moving around in odd geometric directions. The next thing that they will see is essentially something like a fireball, maybe moon-sized lights that seem to move around the sky. And then the next thing is they will hear of UFO activity landing. The next thing they will hear about is hairy humanoids, which we would maybe say Bigfoot. Don't know if they're the traditional Bigfoot that's out there or if it's, you know, whatever it is. And then the last thing is occasionally you'll hear from the men in black. And I don't know, one thing that I want to share with people is John Keel introduced the term men in black about those crazy aliens dressed up in black suits that said they were with the United States Air Force up there in the Point Pleasant, West Virginia area, and all that. So, I mean, John Keel has got one framework. There are several other frameworks that I'm looking at. Number one is, you know, came from Angelia Shear about an Army veteran who had a UFO experience, and then he had a loss of time of over 3 hours, and then he had an absolutely frightening Bigfoot experience. So I think there's several frameworks to look at, and I think there's something there for yet another UFO and Bigfoot book. And maybe, you don't have to say yes or no, but maybe if you find what we're doing interesting, might like to talk to you about working with us on a chapter in a new UFO Bigfoot book. So can I at least ask you about that at a later date? Would that be okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's right up my alley. I've absolutely no Bigfoot is real. The evidence is outstanding, and, well, UFOs, come on.
That's exactly right, and I think it would be a lot of fun, because this research really is fun, because we're looking directly into the unknown, and we're doing things that so many PhD scientists at so many R1, which means top 100 grants research universities, so many PhDs and R1 universities will not look at. I know you talked about the guy at Santa Monica College. That's a tiny little college. But he's an independent thinker and an independent researcher, and he's looking into this, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been to Area 51. He's had, you know, his own encounters, and he was a witness to this whole UFO wave that occurred right off the coast here. So, absolutely, there's a lot of people looking into this.
You see, and he's someone I would call a very credible witness, because is he from a science department at Santa Monica University?
Well, he doesn't really want me to get into too much detail, but he's not the only professor or teacher who's, you know, our witnesses for this book off the coast of California here. I was able to talk to a Coast Guard captain. I talked to a submarine navigator. I talked to another guy who was an electrician's mate on a submarine. Talked to several other Navy officers. Some really amazing witnesses. It's always, I mean, a real honor to talk to these guys. Not that, you know, a housewife or whatever, you know, a gardener or what have you. I've talked to all kinds of people whose job it was, you know, to clean pools. Doesn't make them any less of a witness. But
not at all.
You know what I mean? But, I mean, you have to kind of judge each case individually, certainly. But when you run into someone who's a Coast Guard captain, I mean, that's a level of credibility that you don't often run into.
That's pretty high on the food chain. It really is. And so that's really neat. I don't know what else to say. It's just like it's such a great package that you put together, and neat means a lot of good things throughout the world. And I think that's just so neat. It's really good. So if you wouldn't mind, tell us do you mind telling us what you really think is going on? Kind of like summarize it in a couple of minutes. Would you mind doing that? I know I kind of ask people to like get you know, let's get to the chase here. What do you
right.
think is going on? And just state it like you believe it.
Well, I do. All right. I mean, I started running across these USO accounts, and they were all in this one area, unidentified submerged objects. And the earliest reports I could find were about the 1920s and occurring up to the present day, more and more each year, at least a couple of good ones each year. A lot of reports. I documented about 70, and they're all in this one defined area, you know, in the Santa Catalina Channel, stretching up to Santa Barbara, going south to Rancho Palos Verdes, Long Beach, even farther south to San Clemente. And the first thing that had me scratching my head was, you know, all these accounts in one area. This is the first, what I call a data point, pointing towards the possibility of a base, right?
Okay.
Now the second thing, this is when I really started to scratch my head, was there are a number of cases in this area which don't involve, you know, one or two objects, maybe five or ten, but we're talking 20, 30, 100, 200. Now, that's really unusual. There's not a lot of cases out there in UFO literature involving, you know, 100 objects or more. And there are four, at least, in this area, and several involving, you know, say 20 or 30. And they're coming up from below, you know.
Wow. I want to say this. If you've got 100 or more, from my experience in research from North Carolina State University, where I got my doctorate, you've got a very serious sample here. And this is something that is going to be very difficult to refute. So I think it's wonderful that you found this many. I mean, this is science. This is some serious scientific evidence. And anyway, please, I'm sorry. I get excited and I like to jump in. Please continue.
No, I'm the same way. I start talking too fast. All my words start tumbling around because I really want to get this information out. But yeah, I mean, there was a case on June 14th, 1992. I've interviewed like 30 separate witnesses, all in different areas, up and down through the Santa Monica Mountains, who saw stuff that night. Some saw one or two objects. Some were chased down the street with UFOs, chasing them down the street. But there was a couple who lived high on the ridge, and they saw all these objects coming up from behind a ridge. And they started counting them after like the third or fourth time. They saw a group of like 10 or 20 objects. And by the end of the night, the wife, you know, she says, "I counted 200 objects." And the husband's like, "You know, I think it was closer to 100. I'm like, "Well, you know, at that point, 100, 200, either way, that's too many UFOs all at once."
You got 150 average. Statistically, that is a good, significant sample. Okay, sir.
Right. So, and these were, you know, not helicopters or anything. These were silent objects, half disc shaped or kind of not quite full saucers, and darting around, hovering, turning at right angles, zipping very high, very fast through all areas of the canyon. You know, there was one couple who said that their car was lifted up and they had missing time. So it was a big deal. And there was maybe a year later, there was another event.
I've got to ask a question. I'm sorry.
All right.
May I ask a question? Because
right
now I'm trying to map this to John Keel's transmogrification. So first of all, we have these points of light zipping around. Is that correct?
That's right.
The second thing is, did we ever see larger balls of light moving through the atmosphere?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this area has every shape of UFO I've pretty much ever heard.
Okay, so we have larger moon-sized balls of light.
Absolutely.
Does that sound right? Okay, now, the next thing is, have we seen some type of spaceship?
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, this area has, I mean, metallic craft, saucer-shaped, cylindrical-shaped, manta ray-shaped, triangular, V-shaped, spherical. I said some people tell me, you know, it was like a hexagon, but, you know, one side was kind of off-kilter. It was asymmetrical. All shapes. It's really hard to make sense of and categorize, but
okay.
I would say
right.
most
that's,
of them do look like craft.
That's perfect. Number four, have there been hairy humanoid sightings in the area?
As far as Bigfoot, I didn't find any. I did find a couple of what I would call cryptid encounters involving what appeared to be ghost dogs. And the witnesses were really credible, long-standing residents who are very familiar with the wildlife and really argued with me when I tried to say, you know, maybe it was a bobcat or a raccoon, because, you know, there is a lot of stuff out there in this particular area. And it's like, no, you could see through this thing. You could see through it. It was translucent.
Okay, then you have seen some type of hairy animal slash cryptid
yes.
has been seen. So, I mean, what you've done is you've just gone through four of the five stages of John Keel's transmogrification. That's a word we're going to get out. I tell you what, Preston, will you help me get that word out a little bit more? If I can, maybe you and I can put together an article about it. Let's get that word out. I think more people need to know about it and know that there are stages of this type of experience. I mean, you know, I think, you know, John Keel certainly knew what he was doing. But anyway, that is amazing. That is amazing. So that's just in and around. Just tell us again exactly where it is in and around Santa Monica, correct?
Right, Santa Monica, Topanga, Malibu, Venice, this whole coastline. There's the Pacific Coast Highway, which runs, you know, right along the coast there. And I have to tell you, gosh, I can't go 2-3 miles where I can't pinpoint an encounter that happened right on that road. They should call that the extraterrestrial highway rather than the Area 51 one, because this area, I don't know, something is going on. Another thing that really made me think there might be undersea base here, you know, other than the huge number of accounts, and a lot of these are coming, you know, from the water. There, I have, like, you know, when someone says they're taking on board a UFO, you can pretty much, well, to a large extent, predict what they're going to say if you've researched this for long enough. And by that I mean, you know, someone will say, oh, you know, I've had this abduction experience. I'm like, okay, you know, explain to me. And they describe, you know, a round room perhaps, or being undressed and examined and this sort of thing. And I've got a couple of cases, just a couple, though, from this area where people were not taken into a UFO, but what appears to be an underground base. And the first guy, he's a doctor, you know, a private pilot, really reputable guy. His wife, also a doctor, had a missing time experience as a young boy on Catalina Island with his best friend, and had a number of experiences throughout his life, and finally went under hypnosis. And he went to investigate this missing time incident on Catalina Island. He was in Avalon Harbor on a boat. And under hypnosis, he recalled being, he doesn't know how he was taken off the boat, but he found himself inside this underground area. And he said it was a pretty large cavern, had rock walls that were definitely rough, not natural. I mean, they were definitely natural, not artificial. And his friend was taken off to another area. The guy I talked to was not really the target of the abduction. They told him to just sit down here on this bench and everything was going to be fine. And he said it wasn't gray type ETs, which kind of surprised him because that's what he was expecting. He knew a little bit about UFOs at this point. He saw more the praying mantis type. And so, I mean, this was just one case, but I got another, a photographer who lived along Malibu coast. She had an abduction experience and reported a very similar experience, except she felt she was underground in this large kind of cafeteria type area, you know, like a gymnasium maybe, or a, a very large underground area. But they made me start scratching my head. What is going on here?
Okay, now what? Okay, first of all, getting back to the doctor who was a boy during that abduction, was the subject of that abduction his friend?
Yes. Yeah, I tried to get in touch with him.
And just no go.
Yeah, could not find him, could not locate him. This was too long ago. This was like back in the 1970s, I believe, was when this occurred, that particular incident. But
all
the
right,
these data points started to pile up.
Okay.
And, like, there was another thing that was really curious. I would get all kinds of emails. I'd be contacted by people. There was one guy who contacted me pretty regularly and shared stuff that turned out to be accurate and predicting what's coming around in the UFO field. And he talked about there being a tunnel in this area. He says, you know about the tunnel? And I'm like, no, what tunnel? He says, yeah, there's a tunnel that leads from Area 51 to Edwards Air Force Base, underground, underwater underground, that submarines can travel, and leads from Edwards Air Force Base to this area, the Santa Catalina Channel, San Pedro Channel, and this whole area. I'm like, no, I didn't know about this. And I got contacted by a couple of other people who told me the same thing. And it was some years later that this image came out on the internet of this so-called, quote, Malibu anomaly. Now, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but it looks like this artificial platform off the coast of Malibu, maybe 6 miles, 7 miles out, pretty deep underwater there, and it's huge. It's got a big flat platform and what look like columns and what looks like a tunnel. I mean, it really does on a number of Google images, though I'll admit there's a number of other Google images that don't show this tunnel. So I'm a little on the fence about it, but what I found really interesting was by this point I had plotted all the cases where people had seen UFOs coming in and out of the water here, and it was most active pretty much exactly where this Malibu anomaly was. So whether it's natural or not, you know, whether this is the tunnel or this is the base, I can't say for sure, but it sure is intriguing.
Exactly. I mean, and this is some kind of wonderful stuff. Now, is any of this in one of your books?
Yeah, this is definitely all in the undersea UFO base. I've got photographs, I've got maps charting all these accounts. So, and I mean, some crazy stuff is going on here in this area, like a typical case. Let me see, this occurred in the mid-1980s. This guy's an electronics engineer. He has a fully outfitted boat. He's driving along on the north kind of end of this whole area. Late at night, it's kind of foggy, it's dark, and he sees this green glow ahead of him. And he stops his boat because it looks like this thing is coming closer, and he can't identify it. Now, there's none of the normal navigation lights you see on normal ships and boats. And he doesn't want to have a collision, obviously. But this thing comes right for his boat, and he realizes it's underwater, and it goes right under his boat and stops there for a second. It basically targeted his boat. And this is a pattern I've certainly seen in a number of these cases in this area. These objects come right for the boat, either sometimes above it as well, but you know the USO is right under it. And as soon as it did this, his boat just went crazy. His depth sounders didn't work. His compasses were spinning slowly, and then one sped up and broke off the mounting. His electrical system completely failed. And he says, you know, it was very scary. And this thing, it was bigger than his boat, about 100 feet across maybe. He couldn't really tell. Just glowing green circle under his boat. And it moved off finally, and everything went back to normal. But a typical kind of incident of what's going on in this area.
You know, it's really interesting that you say that when you talk about the typical incident. I want to share one with you that happened in Florida with a good friend of mine. The we have an author who lives here in Myrtle Beach. He's a good friend. His name's Bo Bryan. He did the book Shag, which was probably the preeminent coffee table book about 7 years ago. Bo is the salt of the earth, one of the smartest guys I've ever met. He's a brilliant intellect. And we were taught we were having a cocktail, and Bo told me about being in Florida, being on a canal in a little barge, and turning around, and there was a large orange UFO following them. About 500, 600 feet away, it was silent, but it was large. And they didn't know what to do. And the reason I bring this up, I mean, you know, Bo said, well, they just kept going and the thing went away. My question to you is this, based on the experience from Bo Bryan, and I hope Bo doesn't mind that I mention this, because everybody in the country is going to hear this. What do people do when they have one of these inexplicable experiences? Psychologically, what happens to them? And do they talk about it among their friends and whatever? What kind of experience do you have with witnesses, and how willing are they to share their stories?
Right. Well, I mean, I get all kinds of reactions. There was one lady I called up. I'd been referred to her by a friend, and she was furious I called her. She did not know I was going to call and was not willing to talk about her encounters, and I learned a real good lesson there, you know, to make sure that you have permission to call these people before you do. Not all people are willing to talk about it. It scares them. Other people have seen this stuff, and they're super excited. I mean, they go down there to look for it. At one point, this stuff was so active during the 1970s, people would have kind of beach parties and go and watch these lights coming up out of the water and going back in. It was sort of a thing to do. And so it was fun and, you know, transformative in terms of, you know, there's something out there that is not normal and can't be explained conventionally. So locally, I mean, this phenomenon is known pretty well among the locals who live there. So it's definitely transformed their consciousness in that way. But some people are really scared of it. You know, they don't like it. And others, they're pretty excited about it. They've got their cameras. They've got their... One guy, here's a good example. I did interview this guy. He kind of had both reactions. He was out on, I believe it was the Long Beach area. He's a lawyer. And he saw this object pretty close up, you know, a few hundred yards away, not far. It was triangular, and it was glowing blue, and it came up and hovered over the water. It was, seemed to be affecting the water, and eventually darted off. Well, it changed his life. I mean, he became obsessed with this subject. He had had a childhood experience. He had a little bit of confusion about the time during this incident. It's possible that he's, you know, having more than just regular sightings, because he's, you know, spent basically $40,000 of his money on telescope equipment to start looking for this stuff. That's a pretty extreme reaction.
It might be an extreme reaction, but it's actually very reasonable, because so many discoveries of anything in the sky comes from amateur astronomers. You got to champion a guy that will do that, and folks that will say, oh, that's stupid, let the guys at the big observatories do it. That's not the way it is. So many great discoveries come from amateur astronomers. So, I mean, I think that's great, as long as he can afford the $40,000. Can he afford it?
Well, yeah, he did pretty well, you know, as an attorney. So, I mean, I guess he can.
All right, well, that's good. I always kind of look at, you know, the danger of people spending more money than they can afford and all that. Anyway, thanks. I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting you. What were you saying, sir?
No, not at all. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, you know, the whole point was we've got to be careful about what we do. But when we have a passion for investigation, I think it's good to follow it. I think it's healthy. Because otherwise, I mean, what good are we? We're going to sit around and watch reruns of Let's Make a Deal or, you know, or Pamela Anderson on Baywatch. Come on, you know. That's what we're going to do. I think we should do better than that. And now I've got a couple of things I've been jotting down. Number one, we were talking a little bit earlier about Bigfoot and the spiritual aspect of Bigfoot. And there's a gentleman that I speak with whenever I have a question about that. His name is Kiwani Lasparitis, and he's from Washington State. He's got two books about the spiritual aspect of Bigfoot and how the Bigfoot population comes to him in his mind, and he writes these books. Now, do you know that name, Kiwani Lasparitis?
Yes, and I've read one of his books. Absolutely.
Awesome. Tell me what you think, and then I'll share with you a story. I did an interview with him a week and a half ago, and I'm going to include it in the updated or the second edition of Bigfoot Explorers. Tell me what you think. I think he's an awesome guy.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I mean, he's clearly sincere. And if you want to really look into this Bigfoot stuff, it's not as simple as you might think. Because there's all kinds of theories, right? Most Bigfoot encounters appear to be just what they appear to be, a hairy hominid in the wilderness. But there's a portion of them that have very spiritual aspects. They involve telepathy, invisibility, intelligent conversation with witnesses, and definitely a UFO aspect as well. Most UFO encounters don't involve Bigfoot at all. A huge majority, but there's that one, gosh, I'm going to say it's about 1%, not a lot. And same with Bigfoot. Most Bigfoot, you know, don't have a whole lot of spiritual elements to them. Maybe a little bit more than that, but you see what I'm saying? I mean, here where there's a weird intersection of phenomena, and that lady I was talking about earlier who, you know, basically showed me Bigfoot, was having some of these spiritual aspects. She felt she was like in telepathic contact with this thing and that it wanted to kidnap her. And I'm like, no, you know, don't worry about that. There's no cases of anyone ever being, you know, kidnapped by a Bigfoot. Turned out I was wrong about that. You know, after I did my research, I realized that there was a number of cases involving
yeah.
people who have been kidnapped, right?
And you and I talked about that a little when we had our conversation earlier this week, you know, that what I have read, and it seems relatively credible, I read the articles, is that Bigfoot, that it was believed in the late 1880s and 1890s that Bigfoot could begin to emulate the voice of humans. And then a number of children were lured away. But now, who knows what that really is, and was it Bigfoot or, you know, whatever it was. But yeah, there's always evidence that something bad has happened in an interaction with humans, right?
Right. Well, I mean, as far as Bigfoot, there's a number of friendly encounters as well. People have claimed to be, you know, led home after being lost in the woods, or there's one guy who had a log fall on him, another guy who had a snake bite. Both were rescued by Bigfoot, they claim. So there's a number of encounters like that as well. So just to say, I mean, there's kind of a bell curve there.
Well, I guess we can say there are good humans and bad humans.
Right? Same
and
sort
so
of thing.
There, you know, and so it might be, again, it might be there are good Bigfoot entities and not so good Bigfoot entities. We don't know. But we're just trying to learn. We're trying to explore. We're trying to figure out and categorize what this is. But they certainly have intelligence. And they certainly
oh, yeah.
have intelligence far in excess of a curious but smart puppy. I mean, they're, you know, obviously they're a race of human related individuals. I mean, they are. And people like Kuani, you know, talk about the psychic power of them. And he was telling me a story of how his son, and if you don't mind, I'd love to share this story. I don't know if he has it in his book or not, but he's told me this story twice, and I really like it, that his son, his 8-year-old son, put his hand on a stove, and it burnt his fingertips. Second-degree burns, and the kid was screaming. And they knew, of course, they weren't going to be able to let him go to school the next day. They bandaged it up. They called. The doctor said, bandage it up. Come on in. We think it's second-degree burns, probably okay, but we need to monitor this. The next morning, after praying to the spirits of Bigfoot, the next morning, the kid woke them up early, like 6:30 a.m., and was ready to go to school. And they looked at his fingers, other than some, you know, redness or whatever, the kid's hands were fine. And they let him go to school. And I like that, because Kuani is, I think he's a very no-nonsense kind of guy. And I believe what he says. And I really do. I think he's a good man. And I think that's a wonderful story about contacting Bigfoot, and then getting some results. And he and I are going to talk about that more. I mean, I would assume that you kind of like that story, don't you?
I do, yeah. I'm definitely researching UFOs and healing as well, so it kind of ties into that. But, you know, along that same vein, I didn't get to interview these people, but I got a secondhand story, which, you know, I've never written about,
please.
Because I didn't get to. Yeah, I didn't get to verify it, but it's right along this sort of thing. This was told to me by another witness who did interview the guy, not formally, but was told the story about how he was out in the wilderness. This was somewhere in California. I don't know the exact area. I believe it was the Sierras. And it was just by this riverbed when suddenly this Bigfoot appeared, like literally out of thin air. Didn't walk up, you know, is what I'm trying to say. It was just there. And this guy telepathically communicated with him. And this Bigfoot had another Bigfoot appear, his wife and a child. It was a Bigfoot family. And they basically explained that they're friendly and they do have this ability to shift in and out of dimensions and that they're real. And that's basically the gist of the story. I don't have any more details than that. But what impressed me is their ability to turn invisible at will and to communicate telepathically as intelligent individuals.
Absolutely, number one. And number two, I have heard stories, and I will say that this is in the early research stages, of nature spirits associating themselves with Bigfoot. And I know that there have been a lot of times when people talk about nature spirits and lights floating around on the ground and whatever, you know, and people get very uninterested. But I have heard, and there, you know, once I interview some people or have some of my associates interview them, I think there is a very reasonable chance that nature spirits associate themselves with the appearance of Bigfoot. So I think what you said is right on the money. And again, more research. Don't you agree more research needs to be done on this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are accounts where Bigfoot transforms, you know, into different creatures. One lady was following tracks that transformed from Bigfoot to deer tracks. And, you know, the lady I interviewed, she said there was this dog that kept coming around, and she felt really strange about it because she was wondering if it was connected to this Bigfoot thing or that if it was the Bigfoot. But I don't know. I mean, that's a detail I don't normally talk about. I bring it up here because I think you'd understand it, and we're talking on that
Absolutely.
Vein.
I really like this. Let me ask you this. Just in the abstract, is this a person you could recontact easily and discuss this with them?
Well, I'm still in contact with her, but she's not super responsive. I adore her. I consider her a great friend. I've had a number of amazing experiences. She showed me a UFO. I mean, flat out, it came right up to us. My best sighting by far. Twice she did this. So she's a pretty amazing lady. But yeah, getting a hold of her is a little bit tough because she's actually not in the United States. She's in Australia.
But right. Well, let's do this. We'll give her the code name Margaret or Maggie. So when I talk with you about Maggie, what?
Yeah, I usually call her Wendy. I'm still in contact with her, and every now and then I touch base with her. I told her about my Bigfoot encounter, and she's like, wow, you know.
Well, she sounds like someone we need to become better friends with, because it sounds like she is having the type of experience. And I believe that what's going to happen is we're going to have a renaissance of Bigfoot experiences and people talking to them, whether it's through their minds or whatever. And I think it's going to change a lot about the way we think. I really do, because I know for a fact, if we could talk with dogs, we would know so much more about our planet, about ghosts, about everything, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, I heard some amazing stories about, you know, telepathy with animals. I've had a number of unusual animal experiences myself. They've definitely got a lot to teach us.
Well, they really do. And I mean, I think the more that we communicate with entities like animals and like Bigfoot or whatever, and yes, I mean, I'm raising my hand. Do I believe that we can contact Bigfoot telepathically? My right hand is raised, and absolutely. And I believe that you think that too, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're telepathic, and I think they will respond to certain individuals who are reaching out to them in a benevolent way.
You see, now you said key words there, a benevolent way. The she-squatchers, they go into the woods, and they want to go, as Jen says, they want to go in a good way. They don't go in with men, dogs, or guns. They want to go, they want to communicate, they want to be friendly with Bigfoot, and Bigfoot turns out to be their friend.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important, because if you survey the literature on this, and it's extensive, I mean, there are a lot of books about this, a lot of accounts, many very credible accounts from all over the world, and it's not always a very friendly thing. There are people who have been attacked. There's a few cases of possible deaths, not a lot, really at all, statistically insignificant, so I wouldn't say it's a hostile being. But if you approach it with the wrong attitude, oh, they will chase you out, and they will scare the living daylights out of you. If you approach into their territory, they do a lot of normal primate-type behavior that we see in, you know, other primates. They're very vocal. There's a lot of whistling-type vocalizations. They do a lot of rock throwing, which I found very interesting, because that's what, you know, that Wendy was talking about. She had an incident where this giant boulder appeared on top of her house. There's just no way for it to get there unless it was this Bigfoot, which came up and put it there. I don't know. I mean, it was bizarre. It took two guys to get it down.
I'm sorry. I was just reflecting on part of the she-squatcher's story in Bigfoot Explorers. They went into an area in the woods, and all of a sudden, these half-dollar-sized started getting pitched in front of them. And they knew that the Bigfoot community was saying, you don't need to come here tonight.
Right. They'll let you
and
know.
And that's and that's in Bigfoot Explorers first edition, first printing, which you'll be able to get next week at Amazon. But the point, or at the Kansas City Paracon. But that's so amazing that you talk about the same exact experiences that I talk about with Jen and Jenna of the She Squatchers. So apparently they're not the only people that know this. This is something that people need to realize. Rock throwing. I mean, please don't laugh at me, but that's an exciting thing for you to say.
I totally get it. I mean, if you look into this, it's amazing the amount of evidence there really is. And to hear these people talk about what they've seen, it's incredible. These things are absolutely out there. They live on the very high altitudes. They, you know, transverse ridge tops. They travel by streams. They live in areas where there's a large food source and a water source, and are very aware, usually nocturnal. They don't want to be seen. They know how to evade people and can travel through the wilderness with such, you know, alacrity, such speed that as far as chasing them or trying to track them down, it's very, very hard for us to do that.
Well, sir, you have just vocalized probably the entire knowledge that we have about Bigfoot, and this is wonderful. You are, I mean, not only are you a UFO guy, you're a Bigfoot guy. And it's been a pleasure to hear about this because, you know, not a lot of people, you've analyzed this thing, and not a lot of people have. That's kind of what I try to do based on my academic training. But you've tried to really caricaturize what Bigfoot does and how it operates.
Right. I mean, if you're going to be an investigator, you can't just throw away the evidence because it doesn't fit your theory. And what I've noticed is a lot of researchers, well, you know, they'll talk about UFOs, but they're not interested in Bigfoot or ghosts or any paranormal connection. And, you know, vice versa, that works as well. There's not a whole lot of researchers out there who are willing to just throw away all their preconceived conceptions about this and just let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, wasn't easy for me. I'm not going to say it was easy. I didn't want to look into Bigfoot like I mentioned earlier. But finally, I just had to throw up my hands and say, you know what, there is enough evidence here for me to say that this is absolutely a real phenomena. I ended up writing, you know, two books about Bigfoot, and California is actually the top producer in terms of the number of reports in the United States, is the leader and has just outstanding evidence of all kinds. It's not just footprints. I mean, there's film evidence, there's all kinds of sound evidence, multiple eyewitness reports, scat, and all kinds of stuff. I mean, they pretty much know where these guys live, what they eat, the whole deal.
Wow. Well, I guess what I'll say is, first of all, I was going to interview you as a UFO expert, but it sounds like you are just as much of a Bigfoot expert, and that's wonderful, and thanks. And I want to put that to the side because I want to get back to the UFO stuff. What are you looking at and researching right now, and what do you want us to know that is important about the undersea bases or whatever? What is important for you to tell us tonight?
Well, this is a subject I take very seriously, UFOs. You know, I think we have the UFO technology. I think we have the bodies. I think we have basically what amounts to free energy. And this is a subject that, whether or not you think it affects you personally, it really does. Because if this technology were to be released, and we would just have full disclosure, we would not only have open official contact, but we could, you know, basically solve the energy crisis, the economic crisis, and the environmental crisis in one fell swoop. It's a very important subject. I think there's going to be a lot of upcoming changes with this. You know, I can't prove there's an undersea UFO base, but I think the evidence is mounting to the point where it's the best explanation at this point. I mean, we haven't gotten into a whole lot of the individual cases, but there's a lot of them. And I'm quite sure it's not military, for a number of reasons, mainly because the military does not test fly their aircraft over large population centers. They don't chase cars down the road and wake people up that night in their homes by hovering over them and this sort of thing. And beyond that, a lot of the witnesses themselves are military. I don't know. I mean, I think we're just looking at a very uncertain future about what's going to – I'm not sure what's going to all roll out here, but I can't see it going any other way than open official contact and disclosure. I just don't know how fast it's going to come forward.
I mean, that's a very reasonable thing to say. I mean, you know, let's hope it comes forward sooner than later. But and a couple other things that I've got for you. Number one, are you familiar with the Aurora, Texas UFO event?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a long, what, 1860 or something?
1897.
And first UFO crash.
That's right. And just so everyone that doesn't know, in 1897, a UFO was moving slowly and it crashed in the land that a doctor owned. I'm sorry, it was a judge. And the Masons actually recorded this in their timeline and calendar of Aurora, Texas. It's just a small little town about 45 minutes from Fort Worth. And then what happened was all of the artifacts from the UFO were dumped down a well. And that land happened to be, you know, went along, it was partitioned off and everything. And a family bought that land in the late 30s, 1930s. What happened was 10 years later, they were all sick. And they were actually diagnosed with radiation poisoning. And some people went out to investigate, and they decided to wall off, you know, concrete off and wall off that well. Well, the Aurora, Texas UFO incident has been celebrated for quite a while now. And we passed you know, so many anniversaries of it. A friend of Lyle Blackburn's, Douglas Allen Jones, I interviewed him on ScaryCast. We're going to get a group of people to go out there and try to investigate that, because I've got some techniques that I want to use, and I don't think they've used it. And I know Doug Jones is very excited about it. Lyle said he would be there. I've contacted, and I don't know if you know this fella. His name is Dr. Aaron Judkins. Do you know him?
No, I can't see that. No.
Aaron was the executive producer of the movie Finding Noah. And he's the one that went up, that took the expedition up to the top of Mount Ararat. And Aaron happens to be a friend of mine. He's a very sharp guy. And I told him that I was looking this fall to bring a group to go to Aurora, Texas and investigate this. Lyle said he wanted to go. Doug Jones said he would show us, because he actually has a lot of information from an older gentleman who has passed away that was really trying to put everything together. And thought I might, you know, you can let me know later. Again, this is my excuse to having you on here, but thought it might be interesting if you would come with us to Aurora, Texas this fall. We're going to have an all-star cast, and we're going to investigate this thing because we know something happened, and I think it'd be very interesting. So I'll tell you what, after the show, I will ask you if you want to come with us. More details later. How's that?
Hey, it'd be amazing.
Well, I think with Lyle, with Aaron Judkins, I'll be there. Doug Jones will be there. I think it'll be pretty much an all-star cast. And I think that we may be able to find something about what happened, because you're really the UFO aficionado. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. And the last thing I wanted to mention is that I'm working with Angelia Scher, who is the president of Tennessee MUFON. That's Mutual UFO Network, for those of you that don't know. We're going to be putting on a UFO conference in the Nashville area in either April or May of next year. And I was thinking, as we've been talking, I think you might be a fun guest to have. So if it's all right with you, I'll talk with you about that later. How's that?
Hey, definitely.
I think you'd be a really good guest. So we've got a lot of things we're looking at doing, and they're all important, and they're all fun, because I think everybody that's listening to this conversation tonight loves UFOs. They love the mystery, the intrigue, and the potential scientific benefits of what UFO technology will add to our lives. So what I wanted to say, first of all, is thank you so much for being with us. And now, as I've learned from Papa Stroh, the maestro of wrestling, one of the best friends I've ever had, I'm going to let you have an opportunity. What would you like to plug tonight, whether it's any books that you've got coming out that are out or whatever? What kind of plug do you have for us tonight?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, first of all, and really appreciate it. Had a blast. I just put out a couple of books. One's called Undersea UFO Base, and describes about all this UFO activity off the coast of Southern California here. And another is called Not From Here. This is the third volume in a series of books I've put out about the weirder and more unusual aspects of UFO encounters. So, like, in that book, I talk about, you know, people who have received alien gifts, or UFOs hovering over prisons, the Bigfoot alien connection, people who have been shown the engine room of UFOs and taught how UFOs work, this sort of thing. And, my website, if you want to know more about my stuff, is actually my name. Just Google me, and that should take you there. And, yeah, thanks for having me on the show. It's awesome.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. I know that a lot of people are going to listen to this. We really thank you for being here. I'm so glad that I got that chance email from UFOs Over Cashiers, and I found you, and we talked. And so it's been a lot of fun. And I will point blank ask you this. Will you come back and talk with us again sometime soon?
Hey, anytime. You got it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Well, we're done, and I will I'm Dr. John, and I will say that my plug tonight is Bigfoot Explorers. Check it out on bishopville.org, and by the end of the week, or by the beginning of next week, it will be on amazon.com. So I hope you enjoy it, Bigfoot Explorers. And I tell you what, Preston, I'm going to get you involved in another section of the new Bigfoot Explorers. So, again, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And thanks to everyone that listened. And we'll talk to you soon. If you've got any questions or comments, just send us a message at ScaryCast on Facebook. So thanks a lot, ladies and gentlemen. One more for the records. Now, next week, we've got a very special guest. We've got Devin Tate. He is a comedian in West Hollywood. He's very well known. He's really funny. But more importantly, he is one of the biggest Adams family fans in the world. He was on a documentary that came out about 9 years ago. I met him as I was working on Steampunk Mid-Atlantic. He and I are looking at doing some projects together. I hope you'll join us next week. Again, new time, 30 a.m. on Wednesday. And, of course, Devin is in Hollywood, so he'll be there 9:30 p.m., and it'll be a lot of fun. So, again, thanks to our guest, Preston Dennett. Looking forward next week to have Devin Tate, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks for talking with us on ScaryCast. And also, we've got an upcoming guest, which will be Jenna Grover from the She Squatchers. She is a psychic, and she's going to talk with us about an investigation for Agnes of Glasgow at Camden, South Carolina, so it's going to be a great time. Thanks a lot. We'll see you. Buddy, have a good one, and thank you for being with us.